You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, April 3rd, 2026. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This summer, Vancouver will host 7 matches of the 2026 FIFA World Cup. In the lead-up to major global sporting events like this, a familiar narrative tends to resurface: fears of a spike in human trafficking, particularly for sexual exploitation. Yet time and time again, these claims have been widely circulated without credible evidence or data to support them. Advocacy organizations such as Swan Vancouver have raised concerns about newly introduced RCMP anti-trafficking units, warning that such initiatives may conflate consensual sex work with trafficking. Critics argue this approach risks further marginalizing sex workers and could ultimately determine the safety of already vulnerable communities. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga sits down with Crystal Ladaris, the communications manager at Swan Vancouver, to talk about this issue and why advocating for sex workers' rights and protections is as essential as it is for any other workers in Canada. Here are Gabby and Crystal in conversation. Take a listen.
Hey, Crystal, thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Just before we get into it, could you, for our listeners at home, introduce yourself and a bit about the work you do?
Yeah, so my name is Crystal. I'm the communications manager for an organization called Swan Vancouver. We support the rights, health, and safety of immigrant migrant women engaged in indoor sex work. We're based in Vancouver, but work across the Lower Mainland in 13 municipalities in BC. And my job specifically has a lot to do with advocacy, public education, and debunking misinformation.
Yeah, and I guess on that point of public education and debunking misinformation, can you tell us a bit about this workshop that Swan had done last year and the issue it was touching on, which was specifically moral panic around mega sporting events and sex work? What exactly is the issue here, and how is it manifesting ahead of FIFA 2026?
Yeah, so just to back up, like, a Swan supports women and gender diverse people who are immigrants and migrants. So they're impacted by Canada's sex work laws, as well as the migrants we support. They're facing another layer of criminalization in the Immigration and Refugee Protection Regulations, which ban temporary residents from engaging in the industry. They could be detained and deported if they're found to be working in sex work. So what that means is, you know, the barriers that sex workers face when they try to access healthcare, when they try to call police, when they try to access social services are heightened when they also have that second layer of criminalization through the immigration regulations. And they're often the target of a lot of anti-trafficking campaigns. They're painted as victims because, you know, I guess organizations or police and institutions really play on racist stereotypes that paint these women as victims who are from a foreign country, who are docile and easily tricked. But we know that's not the case. All these women that we support have chosen to do sex work. They have their own agency and they make choices based on what options they have in front of them. Now, if we look around some of the further myths around trafficking, it's often sex work is conflated with trafficking. And around, you know, whenever there's an Olympics, a Super Bowl, any major sporting event, there's this myth that reemerges that there's a spike in human trafficking, specifically for sexual exploitation. We've seen arguments as far back as Athens 2004 Summer Olympics, and since then, researchers have debunked this claim over and over again. That includes here in Vancouver during the 2010 Olympic Games, when local organizations and a couple of faith groups did like prayer walks outside of massage parlors and strip clubs. There were these like PSAs, you know, those ads that you find in like washroom stalls claiming that there was a spike in sex trafficking. So one group, an organization called the Global Alliance Against Trafficking in Women Canada, they looked at the actual police data and determined that there was no concrete or verifiable evidence of trafficking linked to the games. So no cases reached the level of investigation with police, not even evidence of a spike in demand for sexual services. This is not the only research that has proven this. There are studies looking at the Rio Olympics, among other events that have debunked this myth, but it persists, right? So today you see host cities across North America who are hosting FIFA games, pouring money into anti-trafficking public awareness and police enforcement. What we're seeing in Canada is similar. There's an organization out of Toronto called the Canadian Centre to End Trafficking, which published a report in 2024 calling for Vancouver and Toronto and their provincial governments and the Canadian government to remain vigilant about trafficking. So in the report, it admits there really isn't evidence that sex trafficking spikes during these mega events, but it's pushing for trafficking awareness campaigns, and specifically these Spot the Signs campaigns. So I just want to be really clear with this before I lay these out, because it's good to show the examples, but these campaigns are not based on evidence. But what they claim is that there are these visual clues or behaviors that a person can see to identify trafficking on somebody else in the public, right? So, as an example, at the Vancouver International Airport, they're saying that they're getting ready for FIFA and the increase in visitors, and that 85% of their staff are trained by an anti-trafficking organization called Not in My City to spot these signs, okay? So, it's a sign allegedly that somebody is trafficked if they have two cell phones. Another sign is expensive clothes, hair, manicure with no known income. Like, how would you know, right? If you're just looking at another traveler, how they paid for their eyelash extensions. A child with someone claiming to be a parent, that's not. Again, how do you know? I think there's a lot of assumptions that might be made there. And this one's always fun. A sign that somebody is trafficked, according to Vancouver International Airport and Not in My City, too much luggage or not enough. What the right amount of luggage is, I'm not sure. They never clarified. But you do see similarities in these Spot the Sign campaigns. There's some variations between organizations. RCMP also doesn't like manicures and gel nails. But it also says a sign that somebody is trafficked is that they're from a foreign country and they don't speak English or French. The Canadian Centre is very similar to the Joy Smith Foundation, where they really try to play on parents' stranger danger fears. So they say people should look for signs like different clothes, makeup, pulling away from friends, a sudden change in behavior, which there all could be very more likely explanations for these behaviors or signs, but these organizations really want you to think of trafficking.
So what is kind of the impact then on migrant women, specifically when, you know, this panic is heightened and people are, you know, looking out for these signs of something that there isn't necessarily evidence showing is like increasing during these times?
So it creates a moral panic in society, because if you have these dozen or so organizations all sharing Spot the Signs campaigns, telling people in the public to remain vigilant and like surveil other members of the public, they're going to start to see these signs. They're going to start to see trafficking everywhere. They're going to believe it's lurking around every corner when it's not. what we're often seeing is that it manifests as a moral panic around trafficking, but then that's now just used as a justification to crack down on sex work. And a lot of the times that's our community that we support, immigrant migrant sex workers. So many of these mainstream anti-trafficking approaches aren't actually effective in identifying and supporting victims, but instead they encourage racial profiling and targeting. In BC, the RCMP's Counter Human Trafficking Unit just did an operation where they went undercover, posed as either sex workers or sex trafficking victims, and they made contact with 100 clients and arrested a bunch of them. And then they labeled it later as a human trafficking operation. Well, we know because of the evidence that targeting clients endangers sex workers. It really limits their safety strategies. There's an inability here to screen clients, negotiate terms of some of the transactions. Some workers may be displaced to isolated areas. And these operations make the women we support fear police even more. So if they are attacked on the job, or if they experience exploitation, which is what this is all about, right? Then they won't call police. And I can tell you right now, we did outreach recently in Richmond. It's a city outside of Vancouver where this operation took place. And there were a lot of no-shows. So women asked us for safer sex supplies deliveries. And then this operation happened. And then on outreach day, they didn't show up. They're hiding or they're not working anymore. So they're already a marginalized population. They already have limits in making income. And then there's also now a reduction in the interactions between those workers and our SWAN staff, which means there's fewer opportunities to support them and respond to their needs, which may include emergency needs. At the same time, in the news release announcing this operation, the inspector leading this unit is incredibly candid. She states, quote, "These initiatives are intended to disrupt demand for sexual services, raise awareness about the harms associated with the trade, and strengthen community-level deterrence." You know, we would hope that by now, in 2026, that RCMP would probably move beyond this morality-based argument and toward more evidence-based approaches.
Yeah, what would, I guess, a more evidence-based approach look like?
It's very difficult sometimes to discern a harmful anti-trafficking approach from others, because I think they have this idea, they've created this idea that it all has to do with rescue. So it's important for the public to just take a critical look at organizations and what they're really asking you to do. So are they oversimplifying a complex problem and pointing to a simple solution like a signs campaign, spot the signs campaign? Do they push for police as the main solution to this issue? Are they hyper-focused on sex trafficking, but they ignore labor exploitation? And are they pushing for systemic change? So are they calling for an end to closed work permits in, say, the TFW program? For us, it's decriminalization of sex work and the immigration rules that ban sex workers, that ban people from, ban migrants from doing sex work. And is this organization, are they really just pushing for the abolition of sex work? Effective anti-trafficking approaches take evidence-based practices by addressing root causes. So they'll look at poverty, racism, discrimination, harmful immigration policy. A good example of this is the organization I mentioned earlier is the Global Alliance Against Traffic in Women. And they also have, I think, more than 100 member organizations across the globe. And we're a part of that organization. And a lot of people don't know this, but SWAN Vancouver does anti-trafficking work, and we do it while upholding the rights of sex workers. So we speak with women, we visit them regularly. We support them in areas they want us to, so immigration, safety, healthcare access, criminalization. When exploitation does occur, they know who to call for help, and it's likely going to be one of the only organizations that they can access safely and without stigma or attempts to pressure them to exit the industry. So, unlike many of the anti-trafficking organizations, we recognize that sex workers, they may want to leave an exploitative situation and then continue doing sex work elsewhere. And that's very similar to how, like, a migrant laborer may want to leave an employer who's trafficking them, but they still want to work in their chosen industry. SWAN also pushes for a systemic change. So we call to the end of policies that create the conditions that make immigrant migrant sex workers more vulnerable to violence, including exploitation. So that's us calling for the repeal of Canada's sex work laws and those immigration rules.
What are some of the lessons, I guess, that can be drawn from that for other organizations who, are sharing in this concern, but, are maybe not, don't know exactly how to engage with this struggle?
Yeah, I think sometimes migrant sex workers get positioned or separate from a lot of different movements. And I'll maybe, as an example, take like just the general labor or migrant justice movements. But they face the same systems that are targeting migrants more broadly. So that would be like surveillance, data sharing, policing, detention, deportation. The difference is that there's this stigma around sex work that exists in society, and that adds an extra moralistic lens. So that's shaping how these harms are experienced and how, like, police or other institutions justify these harms. We are part of the Migrant Rights Network. We're one of a few organizations that works with or supports migrant sex workers. And I say are relatively new to the network, but the work is the same. We're fighting for against harmful policy, like those sex work laws and immigration regulations, just like MRN is fighting against Bill C-12. And we're really building alternative forms of care and safe places and community. And that's all defined by the people who are most affected. I'll just break it down to this. When you look at the immigrant migrant sex workers that we support, there are a lot of common experiences and motivations here. They left their home countries for new opportunities. They send money back home. Maybe they support several family members. Some migrated as international students. Others were on work visas. There's a lot of single mothers who face the fear of family separation. And they're doing everything they can to build a life here for themselves and their families.
You've mentioned a couple of times that sex workers, when they experience violence at work or things like that, they might not necessarily reach out for help because of things like stigma. So what is the importance of, shifting kind of the view of this from like a moralistic argument to a labor rights argument? What kind of impact does that have on these workers who are criminalized?
So when you look at this through like a moralistic lens, it is just really not based on evidence. And the hypocritical nature of this is that if you're arguing for the abolition of sex work or a crackdown on the sex work industry, and you're clapping at enforcement like undercover operations from police, you're actually cheering on the conditions that traffickers or predators would want to take advantage of, right? So if somebody, especially an immigrant migrant worker, is too scared to call the police because maybe they're on a temporary visa and they could be deported, that means that people who want to attack them on the job will do so with impunity over and over again. That also means that people who want to exploit them and traffic them will be allowed to do so because the immigration laws and the sex work laws really deter migrant sex workers. from calling the police. The Canadian government has reviewed this and looked at the sex work laws, and I think it was a June 2022 report. One of the recommendations from the House of Commons committee meeting was to repeal those sections of the immigration ban on sex work because it unfairly put migrant sex workers at elevated risk of violence and danger. So SWAN Vancouver and, you know, some anti-trafficking organizations at least have one thing in common, is that they don't want to see exploitation of certain populations. But I think people need to let go of their personal views and moralistic views on sex work if they really want to reduce exploitation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to bring it kind of back then to, you know, what we started this whole conversation with, how does, you know, these kinds of things that you're bringing up apply to, you know, this current moment where we are coming up on these mega sporting events in Canada, specifically the FIFA games that'll be happening starting in June. Yeah, how can we, I guess, combat these myths that put people at risk?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, again, it's important to scrutinize what we're actually looking at and what people are actually claiming is trafficking. We could, you know, go right now through the airport and see that we shouldn't be looking at the amount of luggage that people are bringing onto them on a plane and think that that's a determination that that is a trafficking victim. We should be more critical about, you know, some of these public awareness campaigns. I do think a lot of people were critical when the BC RCMP held this undercover operation and called it human trafficking. But these are things that, you know, are happening right now. There are a number of red flags or spot the signs campaigns that are here out in public. And I think our worry too is that we're going to see like even more increased enforcement from RCMP in under the guise of human trafficking around FIFA. I think there's a chance of that.
And so what could be the call then to the public in terms of, you know, facing down this chance of enforcement and crackdown from the government and from the police?
Yeah, I think it's important to look at evidence-based approaches to anti-trafficking that don't put other populations in harm's way. So there surely has to be effective anti-trafficking actions and measures that we can take that, you know, don't compromise the safety and basic rights of immigrant migrant sex workers.
Crystal, thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Crystal Ladaris, the communications manager at SWAN Vancouver, and Rabble labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Crystal. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's hand things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with national news. The NDP's national convention wrapped up in Winnipeg on Sunday, March 29th, with the election of a new leader, Avi Lewis. In his speech to the convention, Lewis expressed his deep desire to see his party form government in his lifetime. Lewis also recommitted to several promises that he made throughout his leadership campaign, including a public option for groceries, internet and phone services, and a wealth tax to pay for these and other new social programs. He also said that he wanted to get Canada off of fossil fuels. In closing, Lewis said, quote, "We cannot wait another generation. We've got to start winning now," end quote. In provincial news, some of the leaders of provincial NDP parties were quick to attack Lewis after he was announced as leader. Both the leaders of the Alberta and Saskatchewan NDP parties blasted Lewis for his opposition to fossil fuels. In a post on social media, Alberta NDP leader Nahed Nenshi said, quote, "It's clear that the direction of the federal party under this new leader, someone who openly cheered for the defeat of the Alberta NDP government, is not in the interests of Alberta," end quote. Saskatchewan NDP leader Carla Beck went as far as releasing a statement saying that she would refuse to meet with Lewis until he reversed his anti-fossil fuel policies. Other provincial NDP leaders, like Manitoba Premier Wab Kanoo, were quick to express their support for Lewis, with Kanoo even appearing on stage with Lewis during his victory speech. Kanoo called the election of Lewis to the national leadership as a great day for the party, and that Lewis was a leader with an inspiring message. Also this week, there was a degree of bittersweetness for Lewis in the wake of his election as NDP leader. Less than 48 hours after he won the leadership, his father, Stephen Lewis, died after a long battle with cancer. Stephen Lewis was himself a former leader of the Ontario NDP and an ambassador to the United Nations. Avi said that even in his final days, his father Stephen was constantly asking for updates on the federal NDP leadership race from his hospital bed. In his victory speech at the NDP convention on Sunday, Avi Lewis shared a touching story of a conversation he had with his father about the NDP forming federal government, saying, quote, "He told me something kind of heartbreaking that his father, David, said to him once. David said, 'Son, not in my lifetime, but maybe in yours.' Recently, my dad said the same thing to me. 'Not in my lifetime, but maybe in yours.' Well, Dad, I refuse to tell that to my kid." End quote. And finally, Tuesday, March 31st was the International Day of Transgender Visibility, and transgender lawyer, author, and Rabble columnist Charlotte Cheesby gave their thoughts on what this day means to the transgender community. Cheesby notes that the transgender community is more visible than it has ever been, but that this visibility comes as a double-edged sword. On the one hand, being more visible can lead to more acceptance, while on the other hand, being more visible can leave members of the transgender community more open to attack. Visibility, Cheesby argues, can be used against the community and make it easier for far-right anti-trans politicians to target them. What's needed, Cheesby argues, is a politics of visibility that draws the public attention to trans joy. And as always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Marenberg for supplying the music for the show. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week.